Cash had always had broad musical interest. His repertoire included black gospel, the blues, traditional folk music, spirituals, work chants, mountain music, 18th century hymns, and Irish ballads. He listened to the Louvin Brothers, the Golden Gate Quartet, and the Carter family. He shopped at the home of the blues on Beale Street, where he bought records by people like Pink Anderson, Robert Johnson, and Muddy Waters. He impressed those who knew him with his encyclopedic knowledge of early American music and unique ability to sing something from memory on almost any subject put to him. When in New York, Cash would visit the folk clubs and record stores of Greenwich Village to keep up with the rising urban folk scene. He befriended up-and-coming musicians such as Joan Baez, Richard Farina, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Judy Collins, and Phil Oakes, and was even paying attention to the more traditional material of the Kingston Trio, who, since 1958, had been recording a mixture of ballads, country songs, spirituals, and folk. It was on their 1959 album, The Kingston Trio at Large, that he first heard Remember the Alamo, and on 1963's Sunnyside that he spotted Jackson. In sponging up these influences, he was displaying an openness that was uncommon in Nashville, but which would contribute to his eventual longevity. "He really got into that folk stuff," says Merle Kilgore. "He'd go out and buy all the folk albums that didn't have national distribution, and he'd go back to his hotel room and listen to them. If he found something he really liked, he'd play it over and over again. He'd dissect the song to see what made it work. He'd listen to Odetta, for example, and he'd point out which songs had English roots and which songs had Irish roots. He loved doing that. He had a Leadbelly album, and he'd put that on and tell me how Leadbelly got the bones of the song from someone else. Then he'd do the same with Blind Lemon Jefferson. He really studied his craft." Songs that told the story of the anonymous builders of the nation really interested Cash. He loved material by or about the pioneers and cowboys, slaves and prisoners, farmers and laborers. As he later said, "I love the traditional songs. I like being challenged to do an old railroad ballad that nobody's heard in 40 years. I like to keep them alive. Gospel, spirituals, southern blues, cowboy songs like Oh, Bury Me Not. Songs with tragedy and murder are a very strong part of our musical heritage. All the songs I loved as a boy, I still love. They come from the same man, the same breath, the same well." Two records that deeply influenced him in this respect were Merle Travis's Folk Songs of the Hills, 1947, and the documentary recording Blues in the Mississippi Night, 1959. On both albums, the pain of hard labor and the injustices meted out to workers were explored in songs linked by the spoken word. Travis had recorded 8 songs that he had learned growing up that had been composed by anonymous coal miners and passed through the generations. Possibly influenced by recordings of the poet Carl Sandburg, Travis gave a lively spoken introduction to each song, setting it in its context. In 1947, Alan Lomax, the renowned musicologist, recorded Blues in the Mississippi Night in New York City. It consisted of 3 anonymous musicians discussing the social conditions that gave rise to the blues, occasionally breaking into songs that illustrated their stories. "Blues is kind of a revenge," says one of them. "You know you want to say something. You want to signify, like, that's the blues. We all have had a hard time in life and things we couldn't do or say, so we sing it." They talk about slavery, levee camps, chain gangs, cruel bosses, and racism. In the sleeve notes, Lomax wrote that the recording showed that people who are virtually illiterate and unschooled can view a complex social problem as a whole. They can analyze it and think about it logically, and can present their views coherently and powerfully, and with great literary skill. At the time of the recording, Lomax concealed the identities of the musicians because they feared they would be hunted down for some of the criticisms they made of their white bosses in Mississippi and Arkansas. Not until 1990, when a CD version of the album was released by Rounder Records, were the names of the by-then-legendary blues musicians Big Bill Brunsey, Memphis Slim, and Sonny Boy Williamson revealed. Cash's interest in documentary and work songs was most obvious on his albums Ride This Train and Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Ride This Train, which used the analogy of a train journey to link songs about lumberjacks, prisoners, and miners, paid tribute to Merle Travis's style of narration. Blood, Sweat, and Tears, a concept album about the pains of heavy labor and the brutality of employers, used a song he had first heard on Folk Songs from the Hills, 9 Pound Hammer, and one from Blues in the Mississippi Night, Another Man Done Gone. Travis moved from Kentucky to California after the war to act in cowboy films and play in Western swing bands. Cash met him on November 15, 1958, when performing on Town Hall Party. Cash was so eager to replicate Travis's sound on Ride This Train that, while Travis was sick with an ulcer, Johnny Western borrowed Travis's guitar to play on Loading Coal and Boss Jack. Holliffe worked hard to change the public's perception of Johnny Cash, wanting him to be seen not only as the most popular country singer of his day, but as a great American artist as well. Part of this plan involved concerts at Carnegie Hall and the Hollywood Bowl. The only reason we did them was because they were prestigious venues, and that it was unprecedented for an artist like Johnny to appear there, says Holliffe. On the afternoon before the New York concert, we had a private reception for him on the top floor of the Time Life building. I had fillets of buffalo flown in from Wyoming for appetizers. I thought that these things would redirect people's thinking about him and his stature. They would combine to give him an allure. In fact, it worked. The Carnegie Hall concert itself, though, was a disaster. Cash had taken so much amphetamine that his throat was dried out and he could barely sing. He dressed in a railroader's cap and jacket that had once belonged to Jimmy Rogers, and everyone involved with the show knew he was flying high. Columbia was going to record the concert for an album, but they didn't even turn on the machine, says Johnny Western. He'd been whispering during rehearsals, but that's as bad as talking or singing in terms of trying to save your voice because the air is still passing over your vocal cords. He was a sad case, but there was a full house and the people still loved him. He was Johnny Cash, and he had showed up. In the fall of 1961, with their fourth child, Tara, only a few weeks old, the Cashes moved a few miles north of Ventura to a new home at 8994 Nye Road in Casitas Springs. Worried about the effect of the Los Angeles smog, they wanted to live where the air was cleaner. Cash bought 15 acres of land halfway up a steep and virtually barren hill and had his friend Walter Curly Lewis, a local contractor, build a 5-bedroom ranch house. To most people, it seemed an odd choice of location, over 60 miles from Los Angeles International Airport with no surrounding community. It was worryingly isolated for a mother with four young children. It was horrible, remembers Roseanne. I don't know what they were thinking. Dad was on the road all the time, and he moved us up to the top of this mountain in this really poor township. We had the most money and the biggest house in the whole area, and we were perched up there all alone, and it was strange. But Cash liked the isolation and the arid climate. Going through a desert phase, he loved nothing more than to drive his car out into the lonely spaces and sit there with his own thoughts. He had already moved his parents from Memphis to nearby Ojai, where he bought them a trailer park to look after. The fan club would be run out of an office in Ventura. Saul Holliffe, who had just bought a home in the province of Ontario, Canada, would live at the house when he was in California. Cash even returned to church for a brief period, after Curly Lewis introduced him to Floyd Gressett, a Texas-born preacher who presided over the non-denominational Avenue Community Church in Ventura and worked with inmates in some of California's most notorious prisons. Gressett shared an interest in the same outdoor pursuits. He had a retreat cabin in the Cuyama Valley, 90 miles north of Ventura, and the two men began hunting and fishing together. Sometimes Cash would go to the cabin alone for several days to write songs. He called Gressett Chief, and Gressett called him Slick. After about 6 months of sporadic church attendance, Cash sent Gressett a note to say that he wanted to be more committed to his faith. "Once I told you that I would join your church when the time is right," he wrote. "Now is the time. Since music is my specialty, you can expect me to have songs played when I'm here. Concerning a guitar in the church, near the end of the Psalms, there is a chapter saying, 'Praise the Lord with all stringed instruments and a loud noise,' or something to that effect. My name doesn't have any bearing. My heart is a pauper, like all men. Only I, as a soldier, will be judged." Cash intended to reform, but he found his need for drugs a more powerful force than his determination to change. Amphetamines controlled his sleep pattern, his health, his eating habits, his temper, his sociability, his concentration, and his longings. He began to suffer from muscle spasms. Voices invaded his brain. He found himself embarking on marathon letter-writing sessions, simply because he had no other way to rid himself of the artificially released energy. A poem he wrote at the time, The Cost in Life, express some of these inner tensions. When I consider why that I live and love and work and die, and know no more than most are told, of new things, books and stories old, and why my Maker lets me live, why He gives the things He gives, for I don't follow many rules, I often walk the way of fools. I often think, Lord, why allow me to live and prosper now? Then I know sometime, some way, He'll collect what I should pay. Why does He not snuff me out? For I don't know what life's about. The debt I owe for sin is high. Still He lets me live, love, work, and die.